Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Buddhahood Without Meditation, Part 2.
What's it like to have nothing? Donna.
Well, every time I would get to the point of starting to feel nothingness or something, something would happen, and either I would go into this almost panic or fear place, and so I'd pop back out and start, writing instructions to the Lord. There was one time where I just felt this incredible grief and sadness. And honestly,
so you decided to go for a walk.
Well, honestly, I find myself trying to stop it because I'm in a group. And like the grief, I don't want to just burst out into tears.
Nobody's going to mind. Except possibly you. Okay, so there's stuff. Is that, would that be a fair summary?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How long? You said it was boring?
Yeah, after the second hour. but I did notice that different things could bring me to awareness, awakeness, without my trying. Sounds. Falling asleep would suddenly wake me up. Things like that, which I was surprised there was quite a bit without making the effort to come back, that you could come back. And so that I see now that it's more very much a natural part of our being and of everyone, that possibility that we are all pretty much the same. And and the thought came to me that, well, in that case, no need to be special or more than how we are.
Okay.
But I did get to the place of being very restless toward the end, and wanting to go eat lunch and tired of doing this, but then when I acknowledged that and just sort of really let that be there, then all of a sudden it's gone. So
stuff comes and goes. That's how I'm understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Carolyn?
It felt, my analogy would be, when you're skygazing and your eyes are trying to see things. It felt like my mind and my body and everything was trying to do something.
Trying to manufacture something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so stories, discomfort, anything. And
seize on anything.
Yeah, anything at all. And I found that there was a build up for me. I got more and more irritated.
What were you irritated at?
That I couldn't stop it.
You couldn't stop.
Sorry?
You couldn't stop. What?
Just all this stuff,
Oh. Okay. Anybody else? What was it like to do nothing? Anne?
My mind was very quiet. And what was arising was quite a lot of physical pain. And at sometimes I was able to rest in it for a bit, but then things would arise, you know, thinking about that I didn't like it and so on. So it would be mostly coming and going around that.
What kind of physical pain?
Well, related to a kind of a chronic thing that I have going on.
Take a look at this book.
Oh, I took a look at it today.
Okay. Yeah. Helpful.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've actually been doing Feldenkrais.
Okay.
Yeah. And also I found the what made a lot of difference was doing the Qigong between the sessions. That made a huge difference.
Okay. Which suggests that there's more of an energy thing than a physical thing.
Which suggests?
It's more of an energy thing than a physical thing. Because when you circulate energy, something balances
yeah.
out. Okay. Anybody else?
What happens as I'm meditating, as you say, stuff arises. For me, it's usually some physical sensation that feels uncomfortable, and I, that's generally I want to fix it. And recently I've been working with giving myself permission to just let it be as it is. And I found it interesting today that I didn't, you know, I didn't have to do anything. That was the, don't do anything. And it was actually like, in some sense, able to just kind of let go. It was okay. But then again, the discomfort would arise over and over again. But the sense of I didn't have to do anything was kind of surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so kind of a new possibility.
Yeah.
Right.
Ajahn Chah, who is a one of the great Theravadan teachers in the 20th century, one of his meditation instructions was put a chair in the center of the room, sit down in it, and see who comes to visit. So, you had various visitors today. Some of them were like the man upon the stair. How many of you know about the man upon the stair? Yesterday, upon the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. I met him there again today. Oh, how I wish he'd go away. So some of yours, you had experience like that. This thing was there, but it wasn't there, but it wouldn't leave you alone, etc. Right, Donna? And others, these people or these creatures come in and make a mess of things for a while, maybe knock you out, and then they leave. What happened? Then you'd be back. Then some more would come along and slap you around and knock you out, and they'd leave. What happened there? Something like your experience, huh? And Carolyn has the ones that come in, they go, and get very irritating and just never leave her alone. And, all kinds of guests. And as Eugene was pointing out, most of the time, because we're very well brought up to be polite, we think that when guests come, we have to entertain them and we have to do something. And the idea of just letting them come in, make a mess of things, and leave. It's a Portuguese saying. Guests always bring pleasure. If not in the arrival, then the departure. Well, this evening, I'm going to give you overall perspective of what we may try to do in these few days we have together. And then start in with some thoughts and reflections that may or may not be helpful to you. We'll just see. We're meant to be practicing or learning about this meditation or philosophical system, actually, called Dzogchen, which is a Tibetan term, of course. It means, probably best translated as the great completion. For a long time it was translated as the great perfection. But more and more people have moved to the great completion. Moving away from the idea that things are perfect, which is a very Western notion and quite a problematic one, to the possibility that things are just complete in and of themselves, which has a very different flavor. Now, Dzogchen is like any other system. It prides itself on being the ultimate system, the highest system, and so forth and so forth. And part of the rhetoric or propaganda there is that there are no paths or stages in Dzogchen. There is there, except that Comptroll, in his summary of Dzogchen in his encyclopedia, says, and well, this system has no stages, but for the purposes of elucidation, we discuss the 16 stages of Dzogchen. And I love this kind of writing. It just makes me chuckle. One of the frameworks that is used very often, and I found it very, very helpful in the Tibetan tradition, you will usually see translated as view, meditation, and action. That's how it's Karma Sisi Chung translated in the Songs of Milarepa. Probably the majority of translators will use that terminology. And it's okay, but I prefer to use to translate the same three words in Tibetan: outlook, practice, and behavior. And we're going to look at Dzogchen over the next few days from this perspective. The first couple of days, two or three days, will be taken up with outlook, and then spend a little time on practice. But there's very little practice to do in Dzogchen, so we don't have to spend a lot of time on it. which is nice. And then look at behavior. Obviously, joke for anybody who has just missed it. Something wrong with my timing.
You just have to make it explicit. Do nothing.
No, I said we're going to spend very little time on practice. You know,
so very little to do.
We came here for the practice.
Yeah, no, that's why I thought everybody would get the joke, but they didn't. So, anyway. this framework is a very useful one for examining really any system or discipline. Just as an example, many people have difficulty understanding where the role of human morality comes in the practice of science. And the fact is, it actually doesn't. It is an external element to the practice of science. Scientists may adopt it as a code of ethics, but it's not intrinsic to the scientific method. Because the outlook of science is only that which can be measured exists. That's the philosophical outlook, which is why when science is ever probing into a new area, the first thing it is tries to establish is some form of metrics. To be able to measure things, because if you can't measure it, you can't talk about it using the scientific method. The actual scientific method, that is the practice of science, many of you are familiar with. You have a bunch of data. You develop a model which explains, ideally, all observable data to date. That's one requirement. It also has to predict future behavior in a way that can be tested. Also has to be the simplest such explanation, that's Occam's razor. And so you develop this model which predicts future behavior in a way that can be tested. You make some experiments and you see whether the new data fits with the model that you came up with, in which case you're not very happy because now you've got to come up with another experiment. Or it doesn't fit with the new model, in which case you're much happier because now you come up with a new model and you get to be famous. That was another joke. I'm really off on my timing tonight. And the behavior conducted with associated with science is that it is a quest, it's an investigation for more complete models, better predictive models, and so forth. And that's what you do. But there is no recognition of intrinsic human dignity or human rights or anything like that within that framework, which is why we can have had in the 20th century, principally, the atrocities of vivisection in the Nazi concentration camps, the atomic bombs, all the nuclear stuff, and pollution, etc., 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 because the underlying view of science is more knowledge is better, and it doesn't matter how you get it. Now, in Dzogchen, it's a very, very different perspective, and we'll talk about the view and the practice and the behavior in connection with Dzogchen. But I want to do this more, not so much as presenting stuff to you, as a process of inquiry. Now, all of you come here with various belief systems. Some of them may have been explicitly adopted, sort of philosophies that you've being exposed to it, which you personally value, and you seek to put into practice and behave in accordance with those philosophies. But they're philosophies, they're systems of ideas. They may be backed up by somebody's experience in the past, may not, they may simply be speculative. They may derive from a distillation of human experience, many different possibilities. But they're something that you've received, and now you try to live by them, etc. So some of those can be quite explicit. Some of them can be very implicit. That is, we've soaked things up from our family, from our upbringing, from our educational course of our education, from our culture, and we may not realize it. One of the more subtle ones that pervades Western culture and has come to pervade world culture in what I think is a highly problematic way is the belief in progress. There is zero evidence that there's progress, but the majority of people believe in it. And that's an example of a subtle belief system, a subtle philosophy. And if you stand up these days and say, well, you know, what's the point of progress? You know, the best thing that's going to happen to you is you get ignored. You may get pilloried or stoned, except those are a little out of fashion. But the questioning things like that is not popular in today's world. And there's all kinds of stuff we get from our family, beliefs about ourselves, which goes into our outlook on the world, internalized perspectives of our parents that don't occur naturally. I've come to the conclusion through my work with people that any negative self-image is always learned. So if you feel you're unlovable or unworthy or etc., this is because somebody regarded you that way and you learned it from them. I don't think anybody sees themselves that way naturally. And those are other levels of worldviews or outlooks we have. So there's an awful lot in this whole subject of outlook. Now, the Dzogchen outlook is a little extreme. Experience is inexpressibly groundless. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? There's a basic space for a single timeless awareness. There's a basic ground or a basic space for a timeless awareness. No. Pretty straightforward, isn't it?
I don't go on a t-shirt.
Pardon?
I don't go on a t-shirt.
That's what I thought, yeah. But all experience is embraceable in openness. Embraceable in openness. Well, I'm going to translate these into English.
That one's a little more comprehensible than the other two.
And there's a way of transcending into a great natural freedom. And I'm using these are fairly reasonable translations. Well, let's take a look at these and try to translate them into English.
What was the last?
Transcending into great natural freedom. You want the Tibetan too, Carol?
Sure.
Okay. Here you go.
I'll put that one on a t-shirt.
No, I think you should put it in the imperative.
But it's not progress.
That's right. And it's not gaining anything. So,
two different definitions of progress here. Though I still feel you have a point in that statement,
Alicia.
Okay. So, so 4 points. And here I'll read directly from the Tibetan. Coming to know definitely that all experience is inexpressible emptiness. Inexpressible emptiness. To discern or that there is a single timeless awareness, natural timeless awareness, in the self-rising space.
Natural awareness in a timeless thing?
Timeless awareness. Yeah, Richard Barron translated what I usually translate as pristine awareness, as timeless awareness. I actually like timeless awareness. It's quite good. I'm always worried about pristine.
Single nature,
A single timeless awareness. Let me retranslate it. A single timeless awareness in a natural, natural, i.e. self-arising space. To embrace all experience equally without falling into any partiality. So that's basically saying all experience is the same. And to transcend or come to a great natural freedom. The usual translation for that is spontaneous presence. Natural presence, though I prefer to translate it. Spontaneous, I always think of things going boing. Flowers after the rain. Boing, boing. It's very noisy. I haven't started yet. That is a natural presence, which is a natural clarity. That is present from time without beginning and effortless.
Couldn't spontaneity mean freshness?
Yeah, it does have that. It's just a personal bias on my part. You know, and, I mean, when you think of a person who's being spontaneous, you think of them. That's right. No.
Why are we friends? I go me all the time.
I don't mind you that you go we all the time. I just don't like the word spontaneous being used in this context.
It reminds you of people going me.
Yes, that's right. It means it's totally my hang-up. That's why I prefer the word natural. You know, which is just like it can be less bouncy. Well, it can be just as bouncy, but it's not limited to being bouncy.
Right.
Okay.
So you're saying something can be spontaneous without going. Mm.
Well, yeah. But so as I say, it's my personal idea. Okay. Now. Page 188. This is in Dujin Rinpoche's analysis outline that he constructed before. Now, these are all wonderful, high sounding phrases, you know, they inspire, etc., etc. And when we hear things like that, most of us immediately start constructing yet another belief system right there. So I want you to forget all of that and just rip up those notes and throw them away. And
really spontaneously.
Yeah, you can do that one spontaneously.
Spontaneously most of
it. Because you all have your own belief systems already, and there's no sense adding another one in here. You know, because then you just get into a war. My belief system against your belief system. How I want you to approach this retreat and this practice that we've been doing is this is an exploration of your experience. And you will find out through your exploration, what's true for you? You know, what's true in your experience? And already some of you have found something out from this very simple instruction of doing nothing. It's like, oh, I can't. Or, I don't know how to do that. Or, maybe it's, I don't want to do that. So it's going to be one of those three, or some combination. I can't, I don't want to, or I don't know how to. Which brings me to another framework, which I want to give to you, which comes from, actually, basic shamatha instruction. But we will refer to it as it is now known as McLeod's WKC model. This was officially named by somebody in Atlanta, so it's not, I'm not the guilty party. The WKC model. Willingness, know-how, capacity. So, I don't want to, that's the willingness part. I don't know how to, that's the know-how part. And I can't is the capacity part. And starting from where we are, all three are our areas that we need to pay attention to. So, when you sit during your practice sessions, you do nothing. If you can sit just awake and undistracted, that's fine. That's all you need to do. How long does that last for most of you? Carolyn?
Oh, about eighth of a second.
1/64th of a second. 1/64th of a second would be that'd be about 20 milliseconds. No, it has to last a little longer than that, because you can't detect that amount of time.
Right on the edge.
Yeah. Anybody else? How long does it last? Claudia?
It varies.
Give me a range here.
Total loss, partial loss.
Partial loss.
Mm. 4 minutes, maybe 5.
2 minutes. Okay. Anita. How long are you good for in this practice?
Today?
Yeah, today.
30 seconds.
30 seconds. See, people are being impressed. You didn't think I was very good, but you got people over here being impressed. Okay. So, Nava, how about you?
I'm around Carl Hans.
Okay. So, all of you, look at your experience today and ask, is it a matter of not wanting to sit there awake and undistracted? I.e., is it a problem in willingness? Is it a problem in know-how? Like, you actually don't know how to do that? Or is it a problem in capacity? You simply don't have the resources, even though we haven't discussed what the resources might be to do that. So, Anita.
Which of those three does falling asleep?
Falling asleep, actually, it could be any of those three. It could be any of them. I would usually say it's more likely to be capacity, but problem in capacity, but it could actually be any three of them. Okay, so let's take a quick survey, and you know, you get to vote as many times as you want, because it could be all three. So how many feel that they have a problem with willingness in this practice? Okay, so we got there's the unwilling crew over there.
I'm going to add mine.
Oh, so we got two more.
Sometimes.
Okay, well, let's just take a few minutes on this. Donna, unwilling. Why don't you want to do this?
I think it's because I'm afraid of it.
Okay. Claudia.
I knew it was there and I didn't want to deal.
You just don't want to deal with it. Okay.
I could feel it coming up and I just...
All right. That's because you don't know how to deal with it or you don't want to deal with it?
Today, it was willingness.
Okay, you don't want to. Franca, why don't you want to do this?
I'm just saying some things that would come to my attention that I would rather ignore.
Okay, Carol?
This is too hard, I'm tired, why do I have to do this?
You came here. You traveled a long way.
And she slept at La Quinta Inn.
I did, and that was terrible.
So, this represents a change of mind or something? Yeah, I'd be deadly serious.
You know what it is, though? For me, I cycle through all of these because whenever it's hard, I'm going to find some excuse.
So, do you want to do it or not?
I do want to do it.
Oh, okay. So, you're no longer part of that group.
No, I'm afraid to die. I mean, I'm afraid that that horrible part of me will be gone when I let go.
You're afraid that horrible part of you will be gone and you don't want to do it because you're...
I'll give you what happened in the actually. Okay, there was that split moment of everything open and one and... No barriers, nothing.
Yes.
And then I have this voice telling me what I'm doing. Okay, what's happening?
Huh? Now you're completely present. Aren't you good?
Exactly. So wonderful, yeah. So I couldn't get rid of that voice. It always, you know.
But you held up your hand that you didn't want to do this.
That's what Caroline said. I think all the three were there. It's the capacity, the willingness, and everything.
So we're just discussing the unwilling part. What's the part of you that doesn't want to do this? Or what doesn't want to do this?
There was a split moment of recognizing a fear to let go of that.
So how many of us experienced a bit of fear on this one? Just this group over here. We could really neatly divide this room up. Okay. How many don't know how to do this? I think that's the problem. Okay, Donna. So, Eugene, what's the problem?
Well, I think, I don't know if I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm doing. I'm trying something.
Okay, let's just take a quick review, okay? The instructions were very simple. Just go and sit down and do nothing. Okay. What part of this don't you understand?
It's much easier to
give us
the five stage,
that would
be nothing.
But...
No, we don't.
I don't think I've ever given you the five stage. Which one? Oh, that one?
What's that? You were holding that from the rest of us.
What is
this
from the
timbers?
That one is a life I know. Franca. I hate to tell you, but you installed it on the website.
I did.
Ages
of doing nothing?
Yeah.
I don't read that shit. I just...
Tell me,
put it on, I put it on.
It's up to you. I mean, I just give it to you, and if you don't read it, that's your business. It's the article I wrote for Tricycle after 9/11. Right, Carol?
Yeah. It was like really long.
We're going back to Jean. So, what don't you know how to do? What part of doing nothing do you not know how to do?
I guess what I am trying to do, do nothing.
Oh, am I doing nothing? Wow. You know, there's a very interesting technique they use in acting school, which is all the people in the class sit in the audience, and one by one they have to go up on stage and do nothing. And it's quite difficult, apparently. Okay. Who else was... okay, Anne. What part of... Do you not understand?
No, it's a little different from Eugene's. Okay. I share Eugene's thing about relief. It's very relieving.
Yes.
It's just that I have a body and I can't stay there because it just keeps handing out all this, stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
But I like it. I don't like the body part, but I like the relaxation of it.
So, if I understand you correctly, then when you're doing nothing, you don't know how to be with your body.
I don't know how to stay there. I can't stay there. I keep popping up.
Yeah, what time duration are we looking at here?
Minutes, maybe.
Okay. All right. Anybody else in the... Yes, Donna.
I guess I had thought until last night and today that doing nothing was resting in the breath. I thought I was doing nothing then.
No, you're resting in the breath.
So when you took that away last night, that if I allow that unstructured time, then my head really takes over. At least resting in the breath, I focused on something.
Yeah, that's right. So without that, it's total chaos.
Right.
Okay. How many in the lack of capacity?
There's a fine line between those two, isn't there?
No, actually there's a very good line between those two. It may be both. It may be lack of know-how and lack of capacity. It's not an either-or. They aren't mutually... It's not. We're not being the Aristotelian here.
I think I'm more...
The lack of capacity side, yeah. Okay. Eli, lack of capacity?
I think so. In thinking about it today, it seems to me it's like any other muscle or any other thing that we're learning to do, and that is working with it. And
perhaps building the energy to be able to hold that place.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me really that's how I lose it is. I'm there, but it sort of disappears, and I'm not always sure that it's even because of another thought.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in that place anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
There's something about when you rest, truly rest, then all of a sudden your energy starts to come up, and
yeah.
It changes the resting. You can't stay there.
It's very inconvenient, isn't it?
So is that capacity? I mean, I don't know.
No, actually, that's a very interesting point, Helen. That's more know-how. Because, as you say, when you rest, then there can be, it's not for everybody, but sometimes there's more energy there. And you don't know how to be with that energy. Okay? So you're getting the picture? Anybody else? Gary, what's your... capacity?
Well, no, it's... you said we could do anything this afternoon, so I couldn't play hooky yet. So there's a lot of movement, hiking and walking and so forth. But there's a certain patterns I have, and I guess I have to be in a capacity with energy that if my energy comes down, these patterns, start taking over. It's just, thoughts. And I can actually feel when the thoughts come up, my body starts to have a certain flavor to it. And then I start getting frustrated with it. And so, for me, I think energy has a lot to do with it. And I think when you look at it, it's sort of like an oxymoron, do nothing, do and then nothing. So, the patterns I have kind of work with that. But I think the movement, when I'm moving and walking, I think I have an easier time with sort of being in my body, but when I'm sitting, I can get the energy blocked, and then the thoughts really go to town. So
okay.
I find this very challenging.
Yeah. Well, that's lapping over into the know-how segment. Okay. Anita?
Here's a snag I ran into last night. So my mind starts, going off in a lot of different ways, and then I notice that, and then I'm wanting to practice doing nothing, so I want my mind not to do that. So I'm thinking about how to get my mind not to do that. So then I'm resisting what my mind is doing. And then I'm not doing nothing because I'm resisting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So.
What's that?
Well,
know-how or?
this is very good. This is very much in the know-how category.
Okay.
And the answer is on page. She gets special treatment. So it's on page. It's on page 44, and I will read it. So the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences.
Preferences. So I'm preferring my mind not to.
You're preferring it one way over the other.
Yes.
So. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. Sound familiar? Okay. And then this is in the know-how category.
Okay, so there's a way you can be with the mind chatter and do nothing.
Just stop preferring. See, I really like this retreat, you see, because the instructions are so simple, I can even understand them and give them to you. No, just stop preferring, that's it. You're
sounds
entitled
difficult.
To... Pardon?
Sounds difficult.
What's difficult about it?
It's counter to all my previous conditioning.
conditions. Ah. Those little belief systems that I was talking about a little earlier.
And habits.
Yeah, all that stuff, right. Okay. So, the reason I find this division into willingness, know-how, capacity useful is that it allows you to know what kind of effort to make. If the problem is lack of capacity, learning more and more tricks just doesn't help. You know, this is became vividly clear to me in rock climbing. You know, learning how to hang by this finger, this finger, this finger, or this finger, or you know, a combination of those, is useless if you actually don't have the strength in your arm to actually hang. Or the wrist, or what have you. So you can learn all those wonderful tricks. Well, good. You have to actually build the capacity. And similarly, one of the quotes that we have up on the website is, if you're rowing in the wrong direction, rowing harder doesn't help.
Make you stronger.
Yeah, it's like Yogi Berra when somebody said, Yogi, I think we're lost. Yeah, but we're making great time. So, this is, you may have oodles of capacity, but if you don't know how to apply it, then you can end up, as many, many people do, rowing harder in the wrong direction. And I think a lot of people here know that from their practice experience.
So they're not sequential.
No. These are not, that's a very good point, Eugene. They're not sequential. These can operate at any time, and one or more can be present. They're just three different aspects. And then there's the question of willingness. Now, let me tell you a little story. Some of you know this already, about a spiritual practice. A group of people came to a Sufi master and said, we'd like to study with you. And the Sufi teacher looked at them and said, okay. Are you willing to put aside laziness and work hard? And everybody in the group said, yes. Are you willing to take a lower place with humility and forego pride and recognition? He said, yeah. And are you willing to venture into what you don't know and let go of what is comfortable for you? Yes. And Sufi Master sighed and said, okay. I'd like you to come next Tuesday evening and meet a group of people who've been studying with me for 3 years. And so next Tuesday, the new group came and were seated, and opposite them was this group of students. And the teacher said to his older students, been studying with him for 3 years, how many of you would rather be lazy than work hard? Stand up. Everyone stood up. How many of you would rather have recognition and pride rather than be humble and take the low place? They all stood up. And how many of you would rather stay with what is comfortable than venture into the unknown? They all stood up just like that. So he turned to the new group and said, so you've seen, the result of studying with me is that you'll be worse off than you are now. Please think about this. What's the problem, Cindy?
No, I was imagining feeling that way.
Go on.
Oh, it's just like, it just had this flash forward to the days from the oh my god.
Can we turn the clock back?
Is it too late to go?
Well, I don't know. I mean, did you rent the car?
I'm fine.
Oh, no, you drove. You drove.
We own the car, that's okay. It's just the gas at this point.
Any other thoughts on this story? Does anybody else have a sort of flash of recognition here? No? Okay,
they're
so.
They're honest.
Pardon?
They're honest. They learn to be honest.
Yeah. Okay, so. Let's review here. How many of you want to know that experience is groundless?
Stand up.
So let me get a read on this. Nobody wants to know that experience is groundless. So
right.
Okay. How many of you want to experience a single timeless awareness?
Can I just experience it for a limited amount of time?
Then it wouldn't be timeless, would it?
No.
No problem.
Well,
then how could
it
be single? It
could be timeless while you experience it.
Yeah. How many of you want to embrace everything that is possible to experience openly?
Oh,
no.
Oh, I want to be tortured.
Oh.
How many of you want to leave what you know to experience a natural, great natural freedom?
Oh, yes.
What was the other translation?
Transcending.
5 minutes.
Spontaneous.
Okay, so we have a problem here.
You didn't give us the questionnaire before we came.
that's a really good idea.
Yeah.
I think, okay. So this is like Cool Hand Luke, you know, we have a problem in communication. Okay, so what do you want to do for the next 9 days?
That all sounds like too much work.
Yeah, well.
No, if you hadn't told the Sufi story, everybody would have been cool.
I don't think so.
We're very honest.
Okay, so, tools. There are a number of tools you have available. First tool is a kind of all-purpose tool. It isn't quite all-purpose. First tool covers both know-how and capacity. and many of you know this from me or from other sources, but I will just take you through it quickly. This comes from a friend of mine who studies Dzogchen quite a lot. He calls it the primary practice. And it has four or five steps, depending on how you approach it. So if you put your books down, we'll go through it, and then I'll go through it again so you can take notes if you wish. The four
Everyone sits up.
You're folding your arms in your belly, aren't you?
No, I'm very relaxed. That's because you can do it anytime, anywhere,
can you not? Mm-hmm. Sorry about this cough. It's come back again. So, You can begin work with any one of the senses. Most people find it easiest to begin with sight, but equally you can begin with the sensations in the body. You could begin with hearing. Smell and taste are sufficiently ephemeral that they're difficult places to start. So just as you're sitting, open to the experience of everything that you see. And by that I mean, don't look at any one thing. Just whatever you see, receive it. The whole field of vision. And when you do this, your eyes may move around a bit. You may find yourself looking at one object or another. And whatever you do, just expand from that object back to the whole field of vision. So we can sit for a little while, receiving everything in your whole field of vision. And when you do this, you may find there's a little physical shift, like an opening or relaxing or something, a little energy shift, and that's fine, that just tells you that you're on the right track. And while you're doing that, then in addition, include anything that arises as sound and smell, taste, and also the sensations, the tactile and kinesthetic sensations in your body. You know, the touch of your clothes, any internal tensions, sensation of sitting on whatever you're sitting, so forth. So that you're completely present in the field of sensory sensations. Just stay there for a minute or two. And then include not only the sensory sensations, but also everything that you're thinking or feeling or believing. All three levels. You may not be aware of all of the things that you're believing, but just include them anyway. So these are mental sensations, if you wish, emotional sensations. Don't move from the physical, from the sensory sensations to the mental and emotional. Rather stay in the field of the sensory sensations and include all of the mental and emotional sensations. And when you do this, you get a sense of a field of experience which is a little arbitrarily divided into outside and inside. So you can just open to the whole field of experience, all of the sensations. And again, you may feel a little shift energetically. That's fine. You may have some funny visual phenomena going on. That's fine too. Now the next step may sound a little odd, but let's give it a try. And that is, here you are in this field of experience. Open your heart to all of that experience. And in the same way that you open your heart to a person, just open your heart to that field of experience. Everything. And then the last step is, I'm going to ask a question, or I'm going to repeat, say a question, which I want you to say to yourself. When you say this question, you will experience a shift. Don't try to answer the question. Just experience the shift and rest in the shift, including everything that we've done up to this point also. And the question is, what experience is all? What experiences all this? Okay, relax. Look around the room. So the four steps are open to the field of sensory sensations. Second step is open to the field of, the field of mental and emotional sensations. Personally, I find it helpful to, at that point, to let the sense of internal and external drop away, so it becomes a field. You can put that as kind of a sub-step if you wish. And the third step for doing it, four, is let your heart open to everything you experience. Or open your heart to everything you experience. And then the fourth is ask, what experiences all this, and rest in the shift. Okay, questions? Comments?
Is this doing something?
Well, yes, of course. We've established that some people are unwilling, some people don't know how, and some people lack capacity, and some people have various combinations. So what I'm doing now is offering some tools to address each of those points. Well, you can really do it either way. You can do as needed, or you can work these techniques for a while. If you want to build the strength, you may just do push-ups for a while and then be able to climb rocks. It's, you know, you go to the mountain and think, I'm not strong enough to do that, and do push-ups, it doesn't really help you that much. Other questions or comments?
So you just keep doing this whenever you whenever you
It's a practice in its own right. It's a very complete practice. And it addresses know-how in that it's quite explicit instructions about opening. So you're moving away from preference, as I just described.
Mm-hmm.
And you will periodically find something that's a little difficult to include.
And then
as you go through this process, you just opening to the experiences, sensations, you're actually transforming energy, which is how it builds capacity. And as your capacity builds, you will naturally become aware of things at deeper and deeper levels. That's just how it works. Because the attention has a higher level of energy, so it penetrates deeper into the system. The end result is that you can rest in the totality of your experience.
So when you find something that's difficult, then is it, then going to the step of heart, would that be?
That you may choose to do it. It may be too difficult to do that. You just include the sensations that tell you it's difficult.
I was a little bit confused about the mental formation. Are you saying whatever arises in the way of thoughts and beliefs for that particular situation, or just
in general?
In general,
just whatever thoughts, stories, emotions are flying around, you just include them. They may be related to this. They may be related. They have a tendency to. I was giving a talk at a Buddhist center in L.A., covering for another teacher who asked me, his wife is having a baby, and somebody was having some difficulty with the practice. He was very much trying to control his thoughts. And I said, do you control your thoughts? And he said, yeah, sometimes. And then I said, pound for pound, an amoeba is the most vicious animal in the world. Everybody laughed because, were you planning to think about amoeba tonight? So we don't control our thoughts. Everything can arise at any time. In fact, I probably have more control over what you're going to think than you do. Just a comforting thought. Other comments, questions? What was your experience with this when you did it?
So I asked a question. You said going beyond preferences is one of the main parts of the know-how of this.
Letting go of preferences. I wouldn't say going. You try to go beyond, that's going to be difficult. But whenever you, I mean, you mentioned this in your own experience earlier, Eugene, when you said you had these physical sensations arising and you, instead of preferring them to something else, you just let them be. And you found that the experience shifted. Now, you don't do this because, oh, if I do this, then I'll have this experience. That's not going to work. But, oh, this is what I'm experiencing now? Well, this is what I'm experiencing now. That's it. We don't have any call on what actually arises in experience. We don't control that. And as soon as we prefer one experience to another, we're setting up a division. Mm-hmm. So that's in the know-how category. Okay, this experience, I don't like this. Okay, now I get to experience not liking this sensation.
Okay. Why
one thing that happens sometimes is that the experience passes, and that's what makes it possible, or that's what was making it possible to stay a little bit longer, because it actually passed.
Were you hoping for it to pass?
I don't know, I don't think I was.
No. This is a very a subtle point, but it's a very important one. As you say, the experience passes.
Yeah.
And then you can just rest again.
Yeah.
But once you start approaching your practice like, oh, there's this experience. So if I just experience it, will pass. Now you're back into the old game.
Right, okay.
This is one of the... This is why we say do nothing, because as soon as you set up a preference, you're starting to do something again. And,
Well, one of the reasons I think when we plan to do that, why it does not work, because we're not with it, we're in the future looking for the result. But if you're truly with whatever it is and not looking for the result, just be with it, then it seems to go.
Yes, but be very careful about harboring that wish that it goes. Suzuki Roshi talks about this Zen mind, beginner's mind, as gaining ideas. And they're insidious. They're absolutely insidious. They can be very, very subtle. And part of practice is letting that go again and again and again, so you actually are experiencing what is arising. Just what's there right now. And this is why we have the three gates of freedom in the Mahayana. Nothing to hold on to. Hopeless and empty.
So. I don't have any control over my thoughts.
That's right.
How am I going to avoid my hopes?
Pardon?
How am I going to avoid having thoughts? Hoping to get rid of an experience, hoping to have an experience. You seem to be saying that you should not hope and not want, but these are thoughts.
Don't believe them. That's all. As you say, you can't stop happening, but when they arise, do you relate to them as facts or thoughts? Pardon?
That's not
Claudia?
I have another question.
Far away. Mm-hmm. No, she has a question. She just...
my next question is, I'm wondering what Claudia's question is. That was my question.
That's
a bad question. I don't know why you always think I do.
I'm wrong. Okay, fine. What's your next question?
How do you open your heart?
You have a husband?
Stop it!
Do you?
I think you've asked this question before.
Yes.
Can you open your heart to him?
He's not here.
But can you?
Sometimes.
How do you do that?
I have no idea.
But you know the experience, right? Okay, so imagine your husband walked in, you haven't seen him for a few days. You just open your heart. Can you do that? Or make it a little easier for you. He's hurt when he comes in here. Can you open your heart? No, no, no. Can just answer yes or no. Can
yes.
You? Yeah, okay, good.
Yes.
Helen, could you hold up your gong den for Franca, please? Do exactly the same thing with the Gonda now. Okay. Thank you.
What if we know you? And you know
okay.
him. And you know me really well.
Yes, but did you get it?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, okay, and that's it.
No, I got it as soon as you said you're a husband. But how do you teach that?
You teach it by exactly the way I just taught you. People have this idea, how do I do it? You take them to the experience, and then you know how to do it. I mean, in the spring, you know, my body retreat was cancelled, but there were a couple of women who got to LA before they got my note that had been cancelled. So I met with them that Friday, Saturday, I can't remember. And went through exactly this practice, because it was part of the power retreat. And one of them just said, open your heart to experience. And so I led her straight to the thing and just said, okay, now do it with this little table. And she just looked at me after and said, I didn't know you could do that. So we don't, everything is experience. We have our ideas about different experiences. So I can do this with this experience, and I can do that with that experience. But if you can do this with this experience, you can do this with that experience too. And if you can do that with that experience, you can do that with this experience. Because in the end, they're just experience. We have all of these categories in our mind. And so the way that I teach that is I don't try to tell them how to open their heart. I connect them with the experience of opening the heart, and then just have them apply it. Does that answer your question? Okay.
When did you add this part?
Ruth Ann added it, I'm not quite sure when, but I went before the retreat. I confer with John and Ruth from time to time. They're constantly revising their stuff as I'm constantly revising mine, and we just go back and forth. And
this is very nice.
Yeah, and I mean, something like that. I've been working with that in some other areas, as you know, but Ruth brought it into this. So, at least I'm pretty sure it came from Ruth. So.
I'd like to go back to preferences.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that our natural human tendency is to want pleasure and not pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now maybe, you know, I mean, that just kind of happens with babies all the way through. So to not have preferences, it seems like it requires training or whatever this whole thing is. And it's sort of an imposition in a way on who we are.
You can look at it in either way, Helen. You're quite right. We prefer to have milk from our mother than not to have milk from our mother. Very simple. So it goes back. And we prefer to have, you know, a warm, loving mother than a cold, prickly mother. And, you know, if you go into attachment theory, the cold, prickly mothers produce very different kinds of children than the warm, fuzzy mothers. You know, so, I mean, absolutely. Why? I see a few people had cold, prickly mothers.
We need to put those in half of the room.
Yeah. You got a lot of sorting in this room today. No. Okay. We're no longer children. And we've gone through the evolution of growing up. And there are a lot of ways that we learn to relate to the world, which served us very well in the course of growing up, but don't serve us very well right now. That's why you're all here. I mean, is anybody here supremely and blissfully happy all the time? What are you doing here?
I came to be unhappy.
The this is easily arranged. Gary, what'd you do with that bear?
What?
The bear. What'd you do with it? Just put it in Carolyn's room, would you? Anyway. Now, because of our preferences, we actually create a lot of suffering for ourselves and often for other people. There's a lot of struggle. And so this is not how a child learns to relate to life. This is how we, at whatever stage of life we're at, are exploring going beyond the conditioning with which we grew up. And so this is very much another stage of development, if you wish. Not everybody wants to embark on it, which brings us back to the willingness point again, and I'm going to say a bit more about that in a minute. How are we doing? Oh, yeah, a bit late. One of the things that actually turns out to be quite magical, and it's what is described here, when you just drop the preference and open to all experience, which is actually that business about not having preferences, is also in that embracing samsara, nirvana, and openness, embracing all experience and openness, just another way of saying having no preferences. Then we find that we experience the world in a different way. You follow? Good. So that's one technique, primary practice. Another technique is Guru Yoga. Guru Yoga is primarily about building capacity and can also be very helpful for developing willingness. Now, on page, all the answers are in here actually. Page 34. There is a 6-line Guru prayer which comes from the Kaju, a Guru Yoga prayer which comes from the Kaju Rinpo. I've always liked this prayer. It's a prayer I learned back in the early 70s. I've done it a lot. Actually, I was never able to make the transition to any other Guru Yoga prayer. I translated it several times, and this is so far the best I've been able to do. And when you pray, now, of course, the big bugaboo is, okay, who's my guru? One way to think of Guru Yoga is, this is how you form an emotional relationship with what is true. In the Tibetan tradition, you regard your guru as Buddha. The typical modern interpretation of that is that it means that your guru is infallible. This is not what it means at all. What it means is that you regard this person, or your experience of this person, to be more accurate, as how you experience awakened mind right now. Or, to put it in slightly different vocabulary, it's how awakened mind is able to speak to you. And it's your own awakened mind, not that the one owns these kinds of things, but it's how awakened mind speaks to you. That's what it means to say you regard your guru as Buddha. It doesn't have anything to do with infallibility. So when you look at it this way, then its devotion arises quite naturally. And obviously, from this point of view, it doesn't have to be a living and breathing person. It can be a historical figure, someone that is a source of inspiration for you. It may be someone you actually have met, or you have hold in high esteem or regard. There's an old saying in the Kagyu tradition, you see Karmapa, you never see the lower realms. You live with Karmapa, you never see the higher realms. And that you see Karmapa, you're tremendously inspired, etc., etc., and your heart opens, and it's great faith, and very good for spiritual practice. If you live with Karmapa, you see him as an ordinary being, and you get into all the usual little roles, etc., etc. So, in Guru Yoga, the Guru is a symbol for what is true, or what is ultimately true, or awakened mind, or however you want to put it. And through prayer, you are letting your devotion, your feeling for it, if you don't want to use that term, find expression through the act of prayer. This reinforces, strengthens that feeling. There's very, very much a component of opening the heart in this. It happens quite naturally. And at the same time, so that's all in the, and then you're praying for these things like, may I let go of the, let self-fixation go, free of need, stop ordinary thinking, no mind, no beginning, confusion subside on its own, all experience is pure being. So, because you're praying for these things and putting your emotional energy into this, you actually start wanting to do this. And that's where it moves in the direction of cultivating or developing the willingness to go into this, in this direction. At the same time, because you're doing this over and over again, and you're using emotional energy being used, the emotional energy is, through this is being transformed into attention, so that when you do a Guru Yoga over a period of time, you do you have a much higher level of attention because you're transforming that emotional energy into attention. So the way this is done, you can just use this prayer and do it informally, and at the end of the period of prayer, you imagine whoever you're using as the focus for your Guru Yoga dissolving into light and coming into your heart, and you and this person being no different whatsoever, and then you sit and do nothing again. You may find that it's a different experience. If you want a more formal practice, then at the end of this text, supplementary practices, page 53, 52 actually, you'll find the a guru practice based on Sukha City, in which you have your choice of a couple of prayers. But that this is the more traditional and more elaborate form of this practice. So that's a tool to address willingness and capacity. And this is a suitable tool, is more suitable for some people than others, depending on people's inclination. In the division of things, the desire, it's a good tool for desire types. I think you just open. Third tool. Addresses the know-how part. How do you do nothing? So I'd like to talk you through this. It's very simple. It won't take us very long. Just sit as if you're sitting in meditation. Breathe in naturally. and then breathe out. And as you breathe out, follow the out-breath. When the out-breath stops, as it always does, don't force it anyway, just be natural. Wherever the out-breath leads you, rest right there. The in-breath will happen, but you don't need to worry about that. Just rest right where the out-breath leaves you and do nothing, right there. So you follow the out-breath, and wherever the out-breath leaves you at the end of the out-breath, rest right there. What do you experience there? Shift to more openness. Okay?
Yes.
So that's where you rest.
Yeah.
Okay. Jane?
I felt kind of a peacefulness at that point. Then I panicked because I forgot to breathe kind of.
Well, if you just let the body go, it'll breathe quite happily. It's been doing this for a few years. It knows how to do that. That the panic, yeah, well, you can run into that, that's right. And you do this again, and maybe you stay a little longer in the panic. And first, you find to stay in the panic, you don't have to do anything about it. Huh?
It helps to keep your attention going.
Yeah, well, it's a way of placing the attention, and then you just rest. Now, when you're doing this, you may end up doing nothing for 250 milliseconds, 500, and that's fine. And you do it over and over again, and gradually you learn how to rest in doing nothing. Okay? So, these are some tools. Some of them are more traditional, some of them less traditional. Use them in whatever way is you find helpful to you. As a way of deepening the level of attention you're capable of, so that you can explore your own experience. That is, creating the capacity and the willingness and the know-how to just rest and do nothing. And it's in the resting and doing nothing that things are going to arise. They always do. And that's going to lead into an investigation, an exploration of experience. You don't have to do anything. It will all come to you, right? Happen. Maybe more quickly or more vividly than you want. But I mean, already it's able to describe that. Like, you start to rest and you hit deep sadness, you hit fear, or you have an intuition that there's something there I don't want to experience. You came here to this retreat you all knew it was Dzogchen. Dzogchen means the great completion. Great completion means everything. So I can say you all came here with the intention of experiencing everything. Okay? You like how I did that, Claudia? So get started. Now, if things are too hot, let me know. that will be the subject matter of our individual interviews. Because there are ways of working with aspects of experience that are too hot, and we all have those in us. And part of it is learning, developing the willingness to experience those, learning how to experience those, and developing the capacity to experience those. Gene?
This may be a little too intellectual, but it seems like know-how and capacity are pretty close.
Well, this is what somebody was saying earlier. When we learn how to do something, then we are able to do something we couldn't do before. But there is a difference between learning how to do something and developing the strength or whatever to be able to do it. I mean, I know how to lift a car. I just don't have the ability, the capacity in terms of strength to do it, but I know how to do it. You follow?
You could teach.
What?
Teach.
I could teach what? Yeah, you just got the card, that's it. Yes, and you know what the third line is? Those who can't teach, teach teachers. Dan.
Does capacity... in this practice and in general, does that generally mean attention?
Yeah, it does generally mean attention. Attention has to be understood to have two components, which we know as mindfulness and awareness. So it's not just mindfulness, it's not just or what the Theravadins refer to as concentration. And stuff. It's the word I really have a lot of trouble with. To use the traditional definitions, one component of attention is being able to be with the object, mind joining with the object. And the other component of attention is the awareness thing, is knowing what's going on. It's the knowing what's going on that allows the balancing to take place. And when both of those are present, then that's what is called samadhi, actually. Well, they're very different definitions of samadhi, but that's one of them. And and that actually comes in the end. It comes about through resting, not through focusing, but both aspects. And that's why I put a great deal of emphasis on resting. And all the power of practice comes from resting, in fact. So the more that one can rest completely, the more capacity one has to experience what is arising. And that's what I've come to. Okay.
Well, it seems like this is like a low know-how, high capacity practice. Low know-how means doing nothing.
Yeah, I understand.
Assuming the willingness is there, of course.
Yeah, you could look at it that way. My own experience is that there's quite a lot of learning. Learning in terms of recognizing when you're doing something. And so one is able to see more and more subtly the ways that one is doing things and progressively let them go. So I'm not sure it's quite so low know-how as that. I mean, in theory, yes, it sounds like that, but in practice...
Because I know what you mean by doing nothing. I mean, it's really not possible to do nothing. I mean, something, the wind is blowing, the trees are growing, the dog is barking, something's always happening. I think what you mean by doing nothing is the doing that comes out of some notion of a constructed self.
Well, it certainly includes that. It goes a bit further. The wind blows. Just because the wind is blowing doesn't mean to say I'm doing something.
Well, I can do something or not.
Yeah, and it's possible to experience it and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm referring to.
Okay.
Carol.
Just a quick question about having an experience and doing nothing. The way I've been experiencing it or noticing is that often I just have a little impulse.
To do?
To change something.
That's exactly right.
So that's yeah. why I'm thinking of doing nothing, is just observing that impulse and letting it.
I'd like to change the word observe to experience. Because observe sets up a duality. So the impulse arises and you experience it. And you do nothing.
But as soon as that impulse arises, things get complicated.
Yes, and this is where both know-how and capacity come in. Because in the beginning, the impulse will arise and you'll find yourself doing something, and then you say, oh, I'm doing something again, come back and rest. But as you practice this more and more, you'll find, oh, there's the impulse. That was nice. And nothing will have happened.
So that's how I was thinking of doing nothing.
Yeah, but it'll develop quite naturally. If the impulse arises, oh, I'm not going to do that, now you're doing something. Okay, there's another question, Helen.
So by resting, though, you do mean being attentive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not gone.
Not gone.
Because that could be a form of resting, isn't it?
No, you're sleeping then.
Okay. Yeah, well, I wondered if that.
You're doing something. You're sleeping.
Okay. But attentive, being attentive is doing something, isn't it?
No, you're awake. And present. That's all. You're awake and not distracted. And being not distracted isn't doing anything. You're awake and not distracted, that's it. Other questions? We've gone way over time, but this is all quite important in laying a basis. No.
I have a question you can answer tomorrow.
No.
It's about advice for the time of activity. Is
well, thank you. Yes, that's very good. And thank you.
What was the question?
When we're not meditating, right?
Yeah.
Or not practicing. Okay. Thank you, because that is something I not included. The periods of practice that we have, you know, 5:30 to 7 or 7:30, we can describe as practicing unmixed with activity. Practicing presence, practicing attention, whatever you want, unmixed with activity. Not doing anything else. The rest of the time, when we're eating, when we're going for walks, having a shower, resting, you know, in our beds or whatever, you can describe as practicing mixed with activity. And the more you can do of that, the better. So that you go for a walk, even though you're walking, don't do anything while you're walking. And it'll be a different experience. Or, if you're using Guru Yoga or something like that, you can just take your favorite Guru Yoga prayer and do it while you're walking. So your walking becomes mixed with Guru Yoga. Or the opening exercise that I led you through. So, and as we go on in the retreat, you find that you drop into a natural awareness. You can also find that you can drop into a natural awareness while walking, or while doing simple activities. And this is how you mix it. If you want to actually do something during that period, the usual instruction, and it's a very good one, is to regard everything as a dream or as a reflection. I'll be saying quite a bit more about that tomorrow night, so you can leave that. Yeah. That's all part of the outlook part. Does that answer your question? So, thank you. Okay, let's break here. It is quarter to... Yeah, it's quarter to...
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.